Delivered packages are a lifeline during a pandemic, but Amazon workers are saying they're facing difficult working conditions.
You know, Amazon has succeeded in a large part by pushing folks, you know, if not to the limit, very close to it. It's a machine geared toward weeding out the pennies of inefficiency.
Yeah, if you can't keep up, you will get fired.
The future of delivery. We're talking about it. It's The Takeaway for March 19th, and I'm Duarte Geraldino with you. Also on the show, how are you dealing with working from home with your kids?
We're trying to keep some structure to the day. So my school-age kids have 4 hours a day of productive work, including actual academic work, looking at a math video, reading, writing.
Your calls at 877-8-MYTAKE, plus how Sub-Saharan Africa is dealing with COVID-19, and some streaming recommendations from Rafer Guzman and Allison Wilmore. Let's start it up. If you're keeping your distance from people or hunkering down, you're not alone. We are all trying to slow the spread of the coronavirus. And as we spend more time trying to practice social distancing, we're also turning to online deliveries. And Amazon is seeing a huge surge in sales. To manage that surge, the company says it's going to be suspending shipments of non-essential items to its warehouses and will be prioritizing medical supplies, household items, and other high-demand products like face masks and toilet paper, all that until April 5th. Amazon is also promising to hire 100,000 additional people to deal with that increased demand. But some of those people, the ones who work at Amazon fulfillment centers, say the company is not addressing their safety concerns during this crisis. Last week, two office workers at Amazon's Seattle headquarters were diagnosed with coronavirus. And on Wednesday, workers at an Amazon sorting facility in Queens, New York, learned a co-worker had been diagnosed with COVID-19. More than 1,500 workers have signed a petition asking for greater protections like paid sick leave and childcare pay. They also want an Amazon facility shut down even if one of its workers tests positive for COVID-19. Matt Day is a reporter for Bloomberg Technology. He covers Amazon and is going to tell us what's going on inside the Amazon fulfillment warehouses as the coronavirus pandemic intensifies. Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Emily Gindelsberger is here, too. She's a journalist who also worked inside of an Amazon fulfillment center. She wrote a book about that experience called On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, what do we know about Amazon? How much more business is Amazon getting over the last few weeks?
So we've got a sense it's just a ton. Amazon doesn't exactly release day-to-day sales data, but, you know, outside consultants say, you know, sales of household items and then essentials are just through the roof. Sales of groceries are through the roof. You know, that's clearly showing some signs of strain in their fulfillment center network that, you know, routes all the packages to their destination.
How difficult is it for them to make sure orders are getting to their customers on time?
Part of what's so tough for them right now is they're coming right off the holiday season where they hire, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of seasonal employees to bolster their capacity. They just got rid of all those people. So this coming, you know, in the dead of March, which is supposed to be a quiet period for them, has just kind of jolted the system. And so it's clearly exposed some kinks in the delivery machine they've built.
So how does all that extra volume affect the people who are actually working in these fulfillment centers?
Well, it's definitely brought back that peak, you know, frenzy holiday season overtime. You know, folks are getting called in. You know, normally if you're in an Amazon fulfillment center, typically it's work 10-hour days. People are getting asked to come back in for mandatory overtime. Seasonal employees are getting called back in. They're trying to hire. You know, folks who we've spoken with say it's a real pressure cooker in a way that it typically is not this time of year.
So, Emily, Amazon says it's adding 100,000 new jobs as millions of Americans turn to online shopping while they're stuck at home. Is Amazon ready for that, you think?
Well, they definitely already have the capacity because, like he said, they expand by, you know, 100,000 people or more every year for peak. But I don't know how easy it's going to be for them to find 100,000 seasonal workers right now. Although I guess with all these people getting laid off from restaurant jobs, this might end up being a job of last resort for a lot of people.
A job of last resort. So, Matt, what is Amazon saying to fulfillment center workers regarding the coronavirus?
know, they're giving them some very basic guidance. You know, all of a sudden there's more hand sanitizer, you know, out throughout the workplace. You know, just this week, they've instituted some more measures to try to keep people safe and discourage them from congregating. But I think like a lot of different moving parts on Amazon, they kind of fail to communicate to their frontline workers very consistently. So a lot of the folks that we've talked to, you know, say that there's not a whole lot of guidance or reassurance coming from the top. It's business as usual. You know, get to your station, make your quota. And oh, yeah, by the way, you got to wipe it down at the end of the day now.
Emily, you called it a job of last resort, and yet you actually worked in an Amazon fulfillment center as part of research for your book. What kind of time pressure are Amazon workers under?
It's pretty heavy time pressure. They call it making rate, which means keeping up with the number of, I was a picker, for example, but this is the case in pretty much every Amazon job. You have a set rate of whatever it is you're doing that you are supposed to keep up with. And if you don't, they make it pretty clear that, yeah, if you can't keep up, you will get fired. So, for example, when I was picking, that means I was going around, you know, the shelves of this warehouse, because I was in an older warehouse before they automated part of that. And so I was walking around like 13 or 16 miles a day, trying to keep up with the pace that they wanted me to go at. And it was quite painful. And the thing that makes it especially, that makes it different from other jobs where there is more, you know, a time crunch, is that you carry around this scanner with you. And you scan something to complete every single task, every task involved with scanning an item. So there's like four or five scans involved with getting one item onto the conveyor belt. And every single one, there's this little blue bar at the very bottom of the scanner that's constantly ticking down, like 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, how many seconds you have left before you're going to fall behind on rate. And it is quite stressful to have that thing running all day, every day, for your entire shift.
So given that time pressure with that clock ticking, do you think that Amazon workers can realistically follow public health recommendations like washing your hands or sanitizing your work area? In your experience, could you have taken the time to go wash your hands?
Not with the rates that I was expected to keep up with. If they really do want people to stay safe, they'll adjust the incentives that they have in place. Because the thing about companies today, like especially really big companies like Amazon, is they often have this sort of micromanagement control over what their workers do, not through telling them to do something and them, you know, obeying it, but because they have these timers that are on everything and that track everywhere you go. I had a GPS, there was a GPS thing in my scanner, so they could always tell where I was. And unless you change those incentives, which are right now the most important thing by a mile, is just keeping up with how fast they want you to go. So Amazon can say all sorts of things like, oh, people are totally free to use the bathroom anytime they want. That's technically true. People are free to use the bathroom. However, when they go do that, that time that they spend in the bathroom is counted as what they call time off task. And you can only have a really limited amount of that in one day.
So, Matt, can you talk to me about the worker who tested positive at the Queens, New York sorting facility? What do we know so far?
So Amazon hasn't told us who this person is, kind of the same privacy concerns they've had with everybody who's tested positive among their workforce so far. But they say that person was sent home from the delivery station near LaGuardia, say they're going to pay them. And then they've said something which is, you know, unprecedented for their response to the coronavirus so far, which is that they're actually going to close the building for cleaning for some undetermined period of time to make sure it doesn't spread within the facility, or at least try to get that done.
And is that what Amazon is generally doing in places where its workers have tested positive?
You know, it hasn't so far. You know, they had a worker test positive in their corporate workforce at their headquarters a few weeks ago. They kept those buildings open as usual for a while. And then when workers tested positive in Spain and in Italy and some of their big logistics depots there, they also kept those buildings open. You know, over the objections of the unions that represent them and then the workforce over there, who have said, you know, listen, you got to cut shifts. You got to shut down the buildings for a while, perhaps. There's been a lot of calls, particularly from European labor, to take this more seriously and shut the place down.
We reached out to Amazon for a comment because we wanted to get the company's side. And the company sent us a statement saying the following. I want to read it to you. The health and safety of our employees and contractors around the world continues to be our top priority. In order to ensure the safety of our teams, we've consulted with medical experts and health authorities and taken a number of actions over the past few weeks. So we've also learned that employees diagnosed with COVID-19 at Amazon facilities or placed in quarantine will receive up to 2 weeks' pay. Amazon is also apparently promising employees unlimited unpaid time off for all hourly workers through the end of March. Emily, what do you think about that? Is 2 weeks' pay enough?
Well, for one, you have to be actually diagnosed with it and have a doctor's note, which for a lot of people is frankly not going to happen. There's a huge shortage of tests right now, and it doesn't seem like they're going to have enough tests to give people this doctor's note to get paid leave from Amazon anytime soon, I would imagine. It's kind of hard to talk about this because there's a kind of linguistic problem with talking about what is part of a good job. A lot of warehouse workers at Amazon find the unpaid time off to be a really, you know, great benefit. Whereas I think a lot of people in the white collar world would think that you mean, wait, I can stay home sick for a certain number of, you know, work hours on my schedule without getting fired, but also it's unpaid. A lot of people in the white collar world would not find that to be a particularly helpful benefit.
Matt, more than 1,500 Amazon workers recently signed a petition asking for greater protections like paid sick leave and childcare pay. They also want a facility shut down if someone who works there tests positive for COVID-19. What do workers need to stay healthy?
So Amazon, you know, when people raise questions about the, I guess, the desirability of these jobs in the warehouses, they tend to say a couple of things. They say, listen, we raised our wages $15 an hour, which, you know, depending on the market is double the federal minimum wage, or it's, you know, at least at it in most markets around the U.S. They say, you know, these folks have benefits. They're covered by the same medical package as the corporate workforce, you know, but obviously for a wide swath of folks, that's not enough. And it's just this tension that's been around for decades of, you know, Amazon has succeeded in a large part by pushing folks, you know, if not to the limit, very close to it, and talking to all those points that Emily made about, you know, just rate and time off task. It's a machine geared toward weeding out the pennies of inefficiency. And, you know, in a crisis like this, sometimes that doesn't rub workers the right way. It's just an enduring point of tension for decades with Amazon and its workforce. And I don't think that, as this petition shows, there's any indication that it's settled or that there's a giant, warm, fuzzy Amazon that's meeting all of its workers' demands.
Emily, one of the reasons that Amazon is surging right now in their usefulness to so many Americans is the fact that so many of us are practicing what's called social distancing. But do you think that the workers at the Amazon facilities themselves can effectively practice social distancing?
It would definitely have been possible in the warehouse that I was working in, which was a few years ago. It was an older model that didn't have quite so much automation. But even in the newer warehouses that I have toured, people are actually set up pretty far away from each other than stand-up meetings, which happen twice a day. However, I think what the problem would be is that this virus can live on surfaces for days, and you're always using equipment that's been, you know, touched by other people. You don't know whether it's been sanitized or not. You're always touching drawers, and it takes extra time to sanitize.
Emily Gindelsberger is a journalist and author of On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. Matt Day is a reporter for Bloomberg Technology covering Amazon. You can read the entirety of Amazon's statement on thetakeaway.org. Emily, Matt, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And if you're working for Amazon or any delivery center, we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MYTAKE. COVID-19 has forced so many schools to close across the country that now millions of parents are home all day with their kids, trying to balance childcare demands with either working from home or trying to find a new job. And I know, because I've got two new kids, infant twins, so I know how hard it is. Next week, we're all sharing a home studio, so it's on my mind too. Now, we asked you how you're managing.
Hi, this is Amelia in Arlington, Massachusetts. This is a really insane time for parents. I feel like anything that would have felt like any kind of work now is pales in comparison to the complete full-time job of homeschooling and keeping our kids sane. I'm fortunate that both my husband and I are educators, so we are drawing on a lot of resources from our schools and from our colleagues, and there's just lots of great ideas floating around, but that doesn't mean that we're not kind of losing our minds.
Many of you told us you're trying to help kids navigate the world of online learning.
This is Sarah Hu from Lakewood Ranch, Florida. My son's third grade teacher has been using her Remind text list to send us great ideas for fun read-alouds to do with the kids, like Games in the Giant Peach, obviously educational websites, and what math topics to focus on. And she even offered to give our kiddos a call one at a time to give them motivational pep talks.
Hi, this is Debbie calling in from Portland, Oregon. We're trying to keep some structure to the day, so my school-age kids have 4 hours a day of productive work, including actual academic work, looking at a math video, reading, writing. Also includes art projects, physical exercise, baking, cooking, puzzles, playing cards, playing an instrument, things like that.
A lot of you also called us, not just to share your experience, but also to offer some words of advice.
Hi, this is Kelsey. I live out in Reno County, Kansas. And my advice to parents is to start each day making a list of reasonable goals that you can do together. Getting dressed, eating food, all of the things that you would normally do. But also include going outside at least once a day, even in the bad weather. Have an art time each day. And most of all, schedule a break for yourself.
This is Kaya from Hingham, Massachusetts. I'm home with two daughters in elementary and middle school right now, and one of the things we're doing that seems to work well is setting up Zoom conferences for their friends. There's now a lunch bunch every day that at 12:30 is starting, and it's helping them stay connected and feel a little less scared in these circumstances.
This is Nate from Providence, Rhode Island, working from home with our 11-month-old home. Been quite a challenge, but not impossible. I think the best advice I can give is if your partner and you are fortunate enough to both be able to work from home, just split up the day right in half. And when you're on kid duty, just enjoy it as much as you can. When you're on work duty, just try and turn it off. Go for a walk, put on some headphones.
Thank you so much for all of your thoughts. Like I said, I'm dealing with this too. I have twin babies at home. Can you hear my son, Olu?
Okay, this is the sound you're going to hear when I have to get off the phone. That is the end of the call.
We're in this together. You're listening to The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The COVID-19 pandemic may still be in its early days in sub-Saharan Africa, but the World Health Organization is now saying the region should, quote, prepare for the worst. The disease is already locally spreading there. And in countries across sub-Saharan Africa, the number of reported cases is now more than 400. This week, South Africa declared a national state of disaster and put in place drastic measures to curb the spread, including travel bans and school closures. Uganda and Ghana both imposed travel bans on the U.S. and parts of Europe. Senegal is prohibiting public gatherings, and like elsewhere in the world, calls for social distancing are widespread.
We know in epidemiology that early intervention is key, and the earlier that you can intervene, the more likely you are to have an impact. Once you get many, many cases out in the population, then intervention becomes much more difficult, much more expensive.
And that's what we're seeing in the U.S. right now, according to Mark Laurie. He's an associate professor of epidemiology at Brown University's School of Public Health, and also an honorary faculty member at the University of Cape Town School of Public Health. He says for some countries across sub-Saharan Africa, time might actually be on their side.
Perhaps we've intervened early enough in South Africa that the epidemic may not get out of control.
I asked Mark why the reported number of cases has been so low in sub-Saharan Africa compared with other parts of the world, and he told me that the actual number is likely much higher.
By definition, there are a lot of people out there who haven't been tested, who are perhaps experiencing minor symptoms, symptoms that aren't severe enough to send them to a hospital or a doctor for testing. So probably, in truth, the vast majority of cases that exist are cases that we actually don't know about. We know from scientists around the world who estimate that for every 20 cases, there are up to 80 unconfirmed cases, meaning that in South Africa, the true number may not be 85 as reported, but something much closer to 470, 500 actual cases.
That is so startling. So you're saying for every 20 cases that we have confirmed infections for, they may actually be as many as 80 people who just don't know or haven't been tested?
Yeah, that's right, who have unconfirmed cases. And that comes from a recent article published in Science magazine just earlier this week from data from China. But of course, it's early days still in Africa, and we don't know how the virus is going to behave here in a whole host of different ways. For sure, it's fair to say that the reported number of cases really dwarfs the actual number of cases that exist in the population today.
So in South Africa, what's been the response on the ground? You're in Cape Town, is that right?
Yes, I'm in Cape Town. I've been here for about 3 weeks, and initially, really, there was very little talk about the virus and the possibility of it coming to Africa. It's interesting. I think a lot of people predicted that it would have arrived here much earlier, in large part because of the strong economic ties that many African countries have cemented over the last couple of decades with China. That would have seemed to be an early indicator that we would get a lot of cases here. But in fact, that doesn't seem to have happened. However, I think a turning point happened just a couple of nights ago. By then, we had about 50 cases in the country, and South Africa's president was on TV on Sunday night on March 16th. He declared a national disaster. He closed half of the border posts. He restricted international travel and closed all schools until after Easter. I was out and about today on my bicycle, keeping a safe social distance, and definitely noticed a decrease in traffic. For sure, some restaurants and shops are starting to close. Big tourist attractions like Robben Island and many other places are shut for the foreseeable future. I think South Africa really is just starting to react and respond to the epidemic. The good news is that it's possible, and an optimist would say that South Africa perhaps intervened early enough in the epidemic that they may be able to make a difference. That is, that potentially the early action that happened when there were only about 50 reported cases may actually stave off a much worse situation.
We're joined now from someone else who's closely following the situation from Lagos, Nigeria. Bukola Adebayo is a senior producer and reporter for CNN Africa. Bukola told us how Nigeria is responding to the outbreak.
As we know, Nigeria is like the most populous country on the continent. So, and there's a lot of footfall from China and other countries. And it was expected that Nigeria will record some cases. They tried to prepare isolation centers. They were testing at airports, temperature screening. But as scientists have told us, temperature screening is not really detecting cases at the airports. So we've had few numbers, majorly from people with history to travel history to the US and the UK. And that is why people are actually panicking. There's a lot of panic in Lagos because the population means that we have a higher risk of spread, of transmission. And people just are worried, like, if these cases are not well managed, it could actually be a potential problem for a country that is actually highly mobile. Nigerians, Lagosians are calling on the government, please pick cases early so that we don't have a situation where patients are detected like 3 or 4 days after they've entered the country. And interestingly, the government imposed a ban on countries that have recorded more than 1,000 coronavirus cases today.
Well, so how does that compare to other sub-Saharan African countries?
Well, other sub-Saharan African countries have put in place restrictions. Ethiopia has put in place restrictions. Kenya is saying, if your country has recorded a case of coronavirus, please don't come to our country. Uganda is even saying, whether you're Ugandan, you're American, or you're British, or wherever, you're Chinese, just stay where you are for now. Don't come into the country. To be fair, the health facilities in sub-Saharan Africa cannot be compared to other parts of Africa, to South Africa, for instance, or even to the UK or the US. Our facilities are overstretched. So the word now is shut all borders. That's what the people are saying. And the government, I feel like they also are reacting to this pressure and these concerns from their citizens. And they are shutting borders. Ghana has said, if your country has recorded more than 200 cases of coronavirus, don't come.
So, Mark, what does the outbreak mean for the public health system in South Africa and in similar countries? We heard Bukala mention the situation in Nigeria.
It's still much too early to tell. Throughout sub-Saharan Africa, not just in South Africa, healthcare systems are often stretched beyond capacity, even in the absence of what's likely to be a huge additional load. So we're working at baseline with health systems that are not perfect, and they're going to have trouble adapting to potential influx of tens of thousands of people. Three things exist in our populations in sub-Saharan Africa that make us particularly concerned about the potential impact of this epidemic. And those are the three leading causes of death: HIV, tuberculosis, and diabetes. All of those things result in weakened immune systems, and weakened immune systems are precisely what the coronavirus itself is looking for. South Africa has the largest number of people in the world infected with HIV, some 7 million people. What experts are saying is that HIV infection per se may not be a particular risk factor for poor outcomes related to coronavirus, but what's likely is that people who are either not taking antiretroviral therapy or who have been unable to successfully adhere to antiretroviral therapy such that they have successfully suppressed the virus, what we call viral suppression. Those people who are unable to do that are probably going to be at very high risk of poor outcomes from coronavirus. Similarly, with tuberculosis, again, this is a disease that compromises the lungs, and compromised lungs, again, are precisely what coronavirus looks for. Here in South Africa, we have about 300,000 new tuberculosis cases annually and about 30,000 annual deaths. Those numbers are likely to go to be much higher in the face of the coming coronavirus epidemic. And similarly with diabetes, which itself, you know, weakens the immune system. And so, again, is the kind of perfect environment for this new coronavirus. People, in fact, with diabetes are 3 to 4 times more likely to develop TB. And it's amongst this population who have these kind of compounding health risks: HIV, tuberculosis, and diabetes, potentially 2 or 3 of those things simultaneously. Those are people that I would be very, very concerned about.
Have countries in sub-Saharan Africa learned any lessons from handling the outbreaks like Ebola that we could possibly apply to COVID-19?
I mean, I think the biggest lesson is intervene early. Those that are slow to intervene are going to have, you know, significantly larger epidemics, which are going to take a bigger personal and economic toll. Those who are early to the game, who intervene before their large number of cases, have the possibility of really stemming the epidemic before it really takes hold. So I think the first and foremost lesson is early intervention is most likely to save lives.
Mark Lurie is an associate professor of epidemiology at Brown University's School of Public Health And Bukola Adebayo is senior producer and reporter for CNN Africa. Thank you both for joining us. Be safe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX.
And to round out our show, let's talk about entertainment in the age of COVID-19. The pandemic is forcing film and TV studios to cancel major releases and halt production on ongoing projects. But as more and more people around the country are confined, mostly in their homes, online streaming is taking a hold in a big way. I've got two people with me to explain how coronavirus is affecting the film and TV industry. They also have some pretty good movie recommendations, good films to watch while you're stuck at home. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, while Allison Wilmore is a film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Rafer, Allison, great to have you back on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So Rafer, one of the first major movies to be postponed was the next James Bond film, No Time to Die. In recent weeks, what other big movies have been delayed?
One of the big ones, I think, was F9, part of the Fast and Furious franchise. That got pushed all the way till next year. And I thought that was interesting because I think that shows the studios clearly had some hopes that we would all pull out of this, but clearly not anytime soon. They moved that all the way till next year. They really want to hang on to the theaters. They really want these movies still, no matter what happens, to somehow appear in the theaters.
It's just so scary to go in some place where you're so close to another person and sit and enjoy a film.
Right.
Now, Allison, NBC Universal also announced it's going to be making more of its projects available to rent at home because of the coronavirus outbreak. What's the plan?
Well, you know, this is a big deal, and I think a lot of people are wondering if it will signal a change, because traditionally the theater owners and the studios, the big studios, have an agreement about the window, you know, between when a movie is in theaters and when it ends up available for home viewing. So the fact that movies like The Invisible Man and The Hunt and the new Trolls movie are all going to be available for rental, not for cheap. Also, it's $19.99 is the price, which is a lot higher than the average VOD rental.
That's $20. Oh
yep,
my gosh,
$20. But I think that what they're betting on, especially with Trolls, is that if you're a parent home with your kids, there comes a point in which $20 seems like a good deal, especially when you kind of start factoring it against the cost of, like, if you had taken your kids to see it in a theater. But it's definitely new territory in terms of these big movies. You know, there's been a long time in which smaller independent films have often been released on VOD, sometimes at the same time that they've come out in theaters. But for big studio movies like this, it's an unprecedented decision to really be like, you could have seen it in the theaters, but now you can see it at home, albeit you have to be willing to pay the price.
Rafer, you know, in the past, there's been this whole drama between releasing movies in the theaters and also on demand at the same time. Why has it been so contentious in Hollywood?
Well, I think what you've got really here is in normal times, you had a demographic, an audience, let's say, that, you know, was pretty accustomed to having everything delivered straight to their doorstep, straight into their living room, right onto the television. You know, the big player in that space, obviously, is Netflix, but there are just tons of other streaming places, Hulu and Vudu and Canopy, the library service, and there's a million of them. And I think people like to have that stuff just, you know, delivered on a plate. And I think over the years, movies have really lost pride of place in the American sort of cultural consciousness, I guess. They're not the dominant cultural force that they used to be because there's so much entertainment out there. And I think the studios have really wanted to hang on to this. And I think that's one reason why we've seen more and more spectacular action-driven blockbusters. These are the things that, you know, are getting pumped out to theaters. And this coronavirus, I think, as Allison was saying, is really put the fear into movie studios that this might be the end. I think that's an exaggeration, but you know, with all, when all you have now is streaming for the next, let's say, 6 to 12 weeks, we're all going to get very accustomed to that. You know, there's a chance, of course, that when they roll all the old blockbusters back out, everyone will breathe a sigh of relief and flood out of their doors and be happy to go out and see a movie again. But there's also a chance that this will seem like the new reality. You stay at home and you see a new movie right on your television. So I think the studios are pretty scared. They're hanging on to those big blockbusters, the James Bond movies, the F9, Mulan, you know, Disney's Mulan. They're hanging on to those because I think those are the ones that they don't want to put on video. They want to keep those for the theaters. But we're going to see what happens.
So on these movies, so many of us are going to be locked inside of our houses, not walking outside, and we're going to be focused on the TV. What do you recommend that we watch or stream? Allison?
Ooh, it's a tough question because I think, you know, do you want to go for comfort food? Do you want to go for something that kind of speaks to your feelings of anxiety right now? You know, there's a lot of talk about how Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh movie, was racing up the iTunes charts because everyone wanted to see a drama in which a pandemic took place around the world. That said, for me, I think if you're going to watch a movie that is about being stuck in your house, I think that there's a way to do that without having to necessarily grapple with a disease and pandemic. I really like this movie called Housebound, which you can actually find for free on Tubi TV, a site that has free things with ads. And it's a New Zealand horror comedy. The main character is stuck in this increasingly scary house because she is under house arrest, having attempted to rob an ATM, which I just really enjoy. And I think, you know, if all of us are stuck here at home, I think that's a particularly good one to resonate with. I also, in terms of comfort food, Moonstruck, which is, I think, just a kind of perfect romantic comedy, is streaming on Amazon Prime and is just about as comforting as wrapping yourself in a blanket. And I also like The Other Guys, the comedy that was there, you know, a kind of goof on action movies. It's a movie with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg, but it also has like some of the funniest sequences with Samuel L. Jackson and The Rock that I will not spoil, but I will just say, if you have time to watch it on Netflix, it is a great escape.
Sounds like good watching. Now, what about you, Rafer? I understand that you suggested some older film.
Well, yeah, I've been thinking about launching a film series in my house. You have to pity my poor children, being the sons of a film critic. But I wanted to, you know, do movies about people who are under siege. But like Allison, I didn't want to watch movies about people dying from a disease. So I was looking for movies that, you know, were sort of feel good about people in a difficult situation. And I came up with Stalag 17, one of my favorite old movies from 1953, World War II movie, American prisoners of war in a Nazi compound, and William Holden plays one of them, J.J. Sefton. He's a cynical loner, doesn't get along with everybody. They all think he's the rat who keeps ratting them out to the Nazis, but he's not. And of course, he has to figure out how to find the real rat and also save his own skin. Holden won the Oscar for it. It's just a great, fun, funny movie, sort of the predecessor to Hogan's Heroes. And at the end, you get that kind of great World War II feeling where everyone sort of pulled together and did the right thing and came out on the other side and made their escape. And so I like that movie a lot.
Any others that you think we should be watching now that we're held up at home?
I would give you one more extremely different movie, and I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here and recommend a movie called Unicorn Store from last year. This was Brie Larson's directorial debut. It was went to Netflix. She plays Kit. She's an art school dropout because nobody at her school liked her paintings of unicorns and rainbows. She still believes they're real, even though she's a grown adult. She returns home with her tail between her legs, and Samuel L. Jackson appears. He's called the salesman. He takes her to the unicorn store and says they're real and she can have one if she can prove she's ready to take care of it. And of course, as the movie goes along, she'll, you know, have to, of course, grapple with her real world responsibilities and find out that it's better to live in the real world than live in a fantasy, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of people hated this film, but for some strange reason, I, a cynical film critic, I really took a shine to it. I thought it was funny and charming. I liked the way it played with reality and fantasy, and Brie Larson's always great. She's really winning in it. It looks like it was made for about $20, but I kind of like that about it too. But if you like those kind of movies, like let's say Waitress or Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, you could take a gamble on Unicorn Store.
It seems like you and Allison are in your elements. You're at home right now. Is that right?
that's right. This is what we do, sitting in the dark, watching a screen anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm starting to really miss that theatrical experience, if only also just to get out of the house.
Oh, yes.
Well, pop some popcorn. Thank you so much. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway, Allison Wilmore, is film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Thanks, Rafer. Allison.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. What a wild week it's been. Thank you for choosing us, for listening, for trusting us with your time, and for writing and calling to share your thoughts. Thousands of people in the Takeaway community reached out this week. You are not alone. We hear you. Your ideas help shape our coverage every day. Quick shout out to the team making this show happen from all parts of the East Coast this week. Our senior producer is Alexandra Boti. And our producer team is Ethan Oberman, Amber Hall, Patricia Jacob, Jackie Martin, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Temi Fogbenly. Polly Arungo is our digital editor, Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our executive assistant and minister of transportation. Lee Hill is our executive producer. They were all amazing working from their homes this week under wild conditions. Here with me on the wall at the station are our sound engineers Vince Fairchild and Debbie Daughtry, our director Jay Cowett, and making his debut as line producer Jose Olivares. I'm Duarte Geraldino. You're listening to The Takeaway. Be safe.